Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How and when do you expect to retire, and have those expectations changed? Few middle-class workers can count on company pensions to support them in retirement anymore, so some older folks keep working strictly because they need the money. Others find they are still mentally and physically fit enough to handle and even relish the challenges of working into their late 60s and well beyond. And as the average age of the world's population continues to creep upward, managers in many industries are realizing they will need to attract, retain, and accommodate older workers in order to stay in business. As my guest today has learned, there are lessons to be found in studying how different economic sectors and different global cultures are making the transition. Journalist Joseph Coleman is Roy W. Howard Professor of Practice in the Indiana University Media School. His new book is called Unfinished Work: The Struggle to Build an Aging American Workforce. Joe, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
So many people are now retiring later than they once imagined they would. I would think this would be harder on those who didn't realize things would have to change until relatively close to the time they imagined they would quit working.
Absolutely. For those people that a longer work life is a surprise, probably it's because of financial reasons. The Great Recession did a lot to change people's expectations and when they would be able to retire and how comfortable they would be in retirement. And certainly for those people, it's difficult to change those plans. The other problem is that, of course, if you suffer a bout of unemployment in your mid-50s, that makes things difficult for a whole bunch of reasons, not only financial but also emotionally. And older workers tend to stay out of work longer, so that eats away even further at their nest eggs.
This book made me realize that for some folks who haven't had so much as a job interview for decades that may have worked for the same company or in the same industry, the process of marketing oneself or even submitting resumes can feel very foreign.
That's something I heard time and time again where I was talking to people who were trying to get back into the job market after a sudden suddenly being laid off. It's totally different than it was 30 years ago. If someone getting a job in 1982 would fill out a paper form, would hand it in to someone who would read over it, and there would be an interview process. Now it's done completely online. There are logarithms that will choose people's names from stacks of applications based on certain keywords and so on. It can be very, very frustrating for people who have worked in jobs where they didn't need to have those computer skills. Suddenly now only even to get their foot in the door, they have to master these skills all of a sudden. And it can be very disorienting and discouraging.
And for those who are still working, this also surprised me, older workers tend to get passed over for like on-the-job training or the special programs to provide extra skills to a certain subset of the workforce.
Yeah, this is really a hangover from the days in the late 70s and 80s when there was a belief, a very widespread belief in the United States and in Europe that companies, in order to boost their profits and the nation in general, in order to attack youth unemployment, rising youth unemployment, that it would be beneficial to encourage older workers, people 55, 56 years old, to take early retirement and move out of the workforce, so that theoretically there would be room in the company to hire younger workers. Unfortunately, they didn't work out very well. Companies didn't actually tend to replace those workers person for person with a worker of a very younger age. But what happened was that it instilled this mindset both in the workers and in managers that older workers are looking to get out, that if someone's 52 or 53 or 54, there's really no point in encouraging them to to reskill or to get into a work some sort of a program where they would learn new skills, because the odds were that they would be leaving within a couple of years. And so it's very difficult for those who want to continue working to get that kind of attention from management. And management also, by that time, sometimes management is younger than those workers and may have certain negative, still believe in some negative stereotypes about what older workers are capable of and what they can bring to the company.
There are, of course, laws in this country against age discrimination, but it sounds like they don't go far enough, or maybe people are embarrassed to even report it when they feel like they've been discriminated against based on their age.
It's very difficult to prove these kinds of cases. So it's also very difficult to measure in any kind of reliable way whether age discrimination is increasing or decreasing. What I relied on in my book was complaints and lawsuits filed alleging age bias, and those increased pretty dramatically after 2007, 2008, and have stayed at a pretty high level. But certainly anecdotally, a lot of older workers suspect that their age counted against them, particularly when they're looking for jobs. You know, it's if you look at unemployment rates, older workers suffer relatively lower unemployment rates than some other age groups. But when an older worker loses his or her job, it is very difficult. It's much more difficult for that person to get rehired. So there seems to be sort of a double standard in some way. Their older workers are valued by their employers, but an older job application walking in the door faces a different set of expectations and a different set of stereotypes. So it's very difficult for them to get rehired.
So we're going to have a lot more older workers wanting or needing to work as just the percentage of elderly to young people in the population shifts, and there are more old people for every certain number of younger people. As we start to plan for those changes in the labor market, what can we do for older folks who want and need to work but maybe don't want or need to work the way they did at the peak of their careers? And do you think this will be the majority of this population?
I saw a lot of people who wanted to downshift or change their job somehow as they were going into their 60s. And I found that the companies that were most successful in adjusting to these changing desires on the part of their older workers was those companies managed to come up with different roles for these older workers to play in the company. Mentorship roles are really, really important because it's a way for the company to capitalize on the experience of those older workers. But at the same time, it's not a physically intense type of work. And also, the other thing that you can build into a mentorship role is that you get you can have a flexible schedule, which is really, really important for older workers. The idea that, well, I want to continue working, but I don't know if I want to do it 40 or 50 hours a week. Maybe if I downscale to like 30 hours a week, that would be more doable for me, that I want to see my grandkids or have to take care of an aging parent. So being more flexible in terms of scheduling and job description and job roles can be really beneficial for both the company and the older workers.
You have a fascinating story in the book about a place in Japan that has found this rather surprising occupation that seems tailor-made for seniors who need a bit of extra cash.
I guess you're referring to the leaf women.
Yes.
Of Kamikatsu. Yes. It's a fascinating story. This is a village in southeastern Japan, Kamikatsu, which was aging very rapidly and then suffered some blows to the traditional industries that had kept the place alive, lumber and orange industry. And there was a killer frost, wiped out all the trees, and the town was like in a real quandary. And the other thing that was happening to that town was that it was aging very rapidly. A very high percentage of the population was 60 or over. And uh, a, a bureaucrat in the Agricultural Extension Office was at a restaurant. He was thinking, well, how can I get – what kind of job can I get for these older workers? What kind of work can they do that will keep them vibrant, that will earn them some money and kind of keep this town alive? And he was in a restaurant in Osaka, and he saw these women pulling the seasonal garnishes out of their trays of sushi and putting them – wrapping them in their handkerchiefs as if they were a very precious thing. And he realized that the town that he was living in, this village, was surrounded by thousands and thousands of flowering trees. And because of the topography of that area, there were many microclimates, so they could grow a real wide variety of these kinds of trees and flora. So he came back and he thought, well, this is what we should do. We should sell garnishes. And a lot of the men were not interested in this because they were, you know, like lumberjacks and farmers, and that was kind of like manly work, and they weren't going to go pick leaves off of trees. But a lot of the women were extremely interested in this idea, and that was really how it started in the 80s. And it turned out that there was no company that was providing garnishes for these restaurants, so they had an instant monopoly almost. It was quite extraordinary and pretty easy work. I mean, you go out in your backyard and you pick the leaves off the trees, wrap them up, and bring them to a central warehouse, and the cooperative would ship them off to places all over Japan. And this provided livelihood and social interaction and plenty of money, actually, for people who were in their 70s, 80s, and there were workers who were even in their 90s that worked for this cooperative.
I think that social interaction component is really interesting because we all talk about work and we talk about the, you know, the compensation and the insurance benefits and that sort of thing. But it's also a place that for many of us includes a component of friendship with our colleagues and a sense of purpose.
Absolutely. I was at a company in Sarasota. It was a manufacturing company, and there was a man there named James House. He's in the book. He was 78 years old. He used to come to work at 4 in the morning because he had the early shift. He would work from 4 until noon, I guess. And he didn't have to do that. But he said, I just like coming in and seeing the other guys and hanging around with the guys. And he was doing a pretty hard job. I mean, he was operating this machine. It required him to stand for 8 hours at a time. But he still felt that interaction was worth it.
Do you think that as, you know, defined benefits that we get from the government entitlement programs start to sort of raise the retirement age, is that going to change our attitudes about when and if we need to retire? Is it going to be economic, or will it be like about societal change and what we want for ourselves?
I think it's really a combination of both. You know, I looked at all the financial arguments that you can make for extending work lives, and they are very compelling. You know, but at the same time, for something like Social Security, there are other ideas for reforms around that could help us avoid raising the retirement age. But I think there are people out there who actually want to continue working. You know, people hit 65, 66 these days. It's not like it was, 30 or 40 years ago. People feel, you know, I've got education, I can keep going.
My guest is journalist Joseph Coleman. We're talking about his new book, Unfinished Work, The Struggle to Build an Aging American Workforce. You can be part of the conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us via email at think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Joseph Coleman. He is Roy W. Howard Professor of Practice in the Indiana University Media School and author of Unfinished Work, The Struggle to Build an Aging American Workforce. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Joe, tell us about Scripps Health in La Jolla, California. Hospital administrators there, I guess, are actively working to keep valuable employees from retiring as soon as they might hit the minimum age.
Yeah, this is an interesting case. The health industry in general is thinking about this issue quite a bit for the reason that the health industry itself is aging. Nurses in particular are aging faster than the workforce. And nurses are vitally important to the operations of a hospital. There are more nurses than any kind of category of doctor you want to pick. There are more nurses than that category. So they really are the backbone of the industry and of the healthcare system. And it's also a very physically demanding job. 12-hour shifts have become standard in nursing, and that's a lot to ask of somebody who's in their mid-50s or late 50s, early 60s. So this is something they're really trying to tackle head on. One of the big problems that they were that Scripps was facing years ago was about 10 years ago was turnover, and that can be very damaging to a healthcare operation because there's a certain institutional knowledge that goes out the door when people are moving in and out so quickly, and they really realize that they have to hold on to their workforce if they're going to be a successful company, and so they've put in a number of reforms aimed at holding on to workers, making it easier to continue working. One of the things that I looked at in the book very closely is the stage retirement. And so if you're of a certain age, say you're 55 and you decide, I don't know if I want to do this 5 days a week, maybe only 4 or 3 days a week would be better. And if I had that opportunity, then I wouldn't retire earlier. I would stick it out until later in life. Then they offer that possibility, but you get to keep full-time benefits. And another interesting thing about the nurses that I spoke to there, a lot of them are women. They have husbands who are older than them who have retired, and and there is that pull in the family, like, come on, retire with me. We can do all these great things. And so maybe, the nurses might think, well, I'd like to do that some of the time and not all of the time. And here's an opportunity for me to have both. I can have both a little more time with my family to do those things that we want to do together. But I also have my work at, 3 days a week. And so that's something that's been pretty instrumental in holding on to some of the workers.
It seems like such a no-brainer. Is it something that I guess a lot of corporate setups simply haven't had to consider before? And so it seems, if the company doesn't come up with the idea, if workers go to management and say, can we do this, are they getting pushback?
It really depends. I mean, I've found often it seems like smaller companies are more adept at adjusting to these kinds of things because they're less bureaucratic. Scripps is an example of a large company that has instituted these opportunities. But probably the most dynamic examples that I've seen have been smaller companies that can – everybody knows everybody else, and so it's easier for older workers to hang on. For bigger companies, a company could look at that program and say, hey, why am I going to pay full-time benefits to somebody who's not working full-time? Isn't that going to cost me a lot of money? And, you could say, well, yeah, maybe you have to hire two people now at half-time to fill that one 40-hour slot and pay double benefits. Scripps makes the argument that we're in an industry where people's skills are really important, and holding on to that person is much easier much more profitable than it is to let them go and then have to go out into the market, do a job search, interview candidates, pick the right one, and then a certain percentage of the time that person doesn't work out anyway and you've got to go through the whole process again, they're saying, look, if we got a good person, then maybe we can make this concession to hold on to them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with David in Frisco. Hi, David.
Hi, and I'm very interested in Mr. Coleman's thesis here. I actually have about 30 years of experience in cardiac surgery sales, and I am in sales, and I've worked for a very, very large, well-known medical company in these device areas. My point is, I was struck by this comment earlier about the double standard in some of the corporations, and I can attest personally that that can be the case. In my particular case, I was a senior rep, and I had delivered probably in the top 10 percentile of quota for the year for my group, and I found that actually there was an age discrimination factor in this large company in that they, without telling me, took my largest accounts and gave them to a younger person who happened to be a female minority, which was fine, but she was just as surprised to discover my accounts had been slipped over to her. So that prompted me to want to look around, but I was compelled with all the experience and, again, in this case, the performance that was delivered, that there was this very subtle, if not unfair, distinction against an age, an older worker. And I'll take my answer about the double standard off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, David. Any thoughts, Joe?
I think it kind of illustrates how difficult it is to prove these cases. I mean, there is this suspicion, but it's very difficult to say, well, you know, definitely that was age discrimination. And the other thing that I wanted to say, if I could add about age discrimination, is that some people, there is the argument out there that the fact that we have this protection on the books can discourage employers from hiring older workers. If you hire an older worker and then it doesn't work out, if we fire them, are we going to be hit by a lawsuit? There are many different arguments around this issue, but I think it's probably one of the most difficult ones to really sort out, just because discrimination can be subconscious discrimination. Maybe we all harbor beliefs and stereotypes about different groups and might just feel, oh, this guy, I don't know, there's something about him. Is he going to be able to do the new technology, you know, without saying, oh, look at his age, you know, and it can be very difficult on both sides, I think.
What about the fact that I don't have my this figure in front of me right now, but I think people are at mm-hmm. sort of the top of their earning potential around the age of 55. Is that something that makes companies more eager to shed older workers and bring on younger ones?
Yes. I mean, I think anybody who – certainly for the individual, you kind of know if you're – earning a certain amount of money that somebody somewhere in the accounting office is looking and wondering what, you know, how much money they could save by somehow encouraging you to leave the company. Certainly that's the case. I think when I'm looking at around at different countries' programs, like in Japan, they have a system where just like in the States, you know, you're at your highest earning potential when you're in mid-50s and so on. They have long had a standard retirement age at 60. And what they're doing these days is they're moving that to 65. But they're also allowing companies to officially retire people and then hire them back. And so you retire with your full benefits. You get whatever pension is coming to you or severance or whatever you're supposed to get. And then you're hired back at a lower pay scale when you're 60 or 62 or whatever the company decides to start this program. And your job usually is different. And this is kind of a problem with some of these things is sometimes they hire them back at exactly the same job but pay them, you know, half or a third less than they were getting before. But I think people, you know, at this age, usually, depending on your financial service situation, your own personal financial situation, people who are, you know, in their 60s and looking to work, I haven't come across many people who say, I want it because I want to make a lot of money now. People are doing it because they want to continue working. They want to continue sort of exercising whatever experience they have. They want to stay active. They want to be socially plugged in. And so it seems like a lot of people, and it's a personal decision, but it seems like a lot of people are willing to say, okay, you know, maybe I'm going to make a little less money, but maybe I have to work a little less too. You know, maybe I'll only work 3 or 4 days a week. And I'm willing to make that trade-off. I think that gets back to the thing we were talking about Scripps before, how they would have a staged retirement system where someone would just work 3 days. Now, those people are just being paid for those 3 days. They're just getting the full-time benefits. That's the payoff on that end. But the pay does go down if you work less.
Interesting email here from Catherine, who writes, "You've been addressing the desire to stay in the workforce for social reasons and for purpose. Many retirees have found these in volunteer work. As more and more are staying in the paid workforce, how might that challenge nonprofit organizations that have relied on retirees for their main workforce?" Interesting question.
That is an interesting question. I don't know if I have an answer for it, actually. I don't know. I guess it depends on whether those same people that would have volunteered are working and therefore they're drawing away the labor from volunteer work. But certainly the number of Americans in that age group is going to increase. So I wouldn't think that there'll be a shortage of people in their 60s and 70s over the next few decades to fill both of those areas, both work and volunteer, quite adequately.
Tell us a little bit about the problems taking place in France right now, where it's like anathema to suggest that anybody increase the retirement age or that anyone should have to work beyond, is it like 60 or 62 these days?
Yeah, 62 is the I think that comes into effect in 2017, that 62 will be the minimum age for the lowest level of benefits for a public pension. You know, France is an interesting case because they went in very heavily into this idea that if we move all the older people out of the workforce, that'll make room for the younger people. And they've had a persistently high youth unemployment level for decades, and it's been a big problem for them that they've been trying to solve. It turned out that it didn't really work that way, but still, they created a vast bureaucracy that's geared towards early retirement. There are so many different ways to retire early in France. You can, if you're unemployed, then you can go permanently on unemployment until you retire, or you can. It's very easy to claim workers' compensation is very easy, or some sort of a disability, and so on. So there are many, many exits from the workforce for older French people. And it has become almost like a cultural – something that they're proud of. You know, this is part of our patrimony as French citizens. You know, the state provides for things. State provides for health. State provides for education. And the state provides us with a decent, humane pension. And so to see any of that whittled away, you get some very strong pushback from labor unions and from people in general. But at the same time, they're aging pretty rapidly, not quite on par with Germany, but because they have a higher birth rate than Germany. So they have more younger people coming into the population. But they still have a pretty quickly aging society, and they're aware of that. I think that they but part of the problem is this bureaucracy that they've built up around early retirement has been very difficult to dismantle.
So what has a country like Sweden done to keep so many older workers active in the workforce?
Sweden is another interesting case. Those are the two countries that I concentrated on when I went to Europe, just because I found that Europe, There was no typical European country that I could say this is what things are like in Europe. Every country was unique, obviously, in its own way, particularly in this issue. And Sweden has Sweden in the United States, Sweden is very famous as, the ultimate welfare state. But actually, Sweden had a very deep economic recession in the early 90s. And the experience of that, that really drove them to dismantle some of the bureaucratic structures that have built up around, what we think of as the welfare state. But even before that, the idea that you work till 65 has been enshrined really in Swedish law actually since 1913, I think. So they have long sort of gone to work accepting the idea that I'm going to work till 65. And then it was, the states and companies' job to make sure that I could do that until I was 65. And they have some really interesting bureaucratic structures, not really bureaucratic, but set up between labor unions and companies to help people hold on to their jobs or make a transition to new jobs. One of these things is called they're called job councils, and there are many of these in different industries. And what happens is if you get laid off from, say, Ericsson, a major telecommunications company. You get laid off from Ericsson. You go to the Ericsson Job Council. It's got some other name probably. And there's a counselor and there's like an office where they will scrutinize your skills, look at your resume, try to figure out, what kinds of skills do you have. And they also have their fingers on the pulse of the job market. Okay, what you need to get back into the workforce, you need to develop these other skills. And they'll actually send people to school, give them counseling so that they can get back to work. And it's worked quite well, actually.
Joseph Coleman is with us. He's professor of practice in the Indiana University Media School and author of the new book, Unfinished Work, The Struggle to Build an Aging American Workforce. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Joseph Coleman, Roy W. Howard Professor of Practice in the Indiana University Media School and author of Unfinished Work, The Struggle to Build an Aging American Workforce. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. We have Peter on the line in Dallas. Hi, Peter.
Hello, Chris. How are you doing? You're doing a great job.
Thank you.
Joseph, thank you for your work. See that there are two big ideas in conflict here as you've represented it. I want to ask you a question about it. The two ideas are that we seem to have a societal tendency to negatively discriminate on non-performance, non-job performance related demographic characteristics. So the issues of age, gender, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, religion, disability, we discriminate based on those categories. The other piece that's a major idea that you've talked about is that organizations need to be able to get work done consistently well, high quality, low cost, all that stuff.
Right.
So you set this up. I really like what you're saying. The thing that keeps going through my mind is what are the organization design levers? What are the levers inside the way we glue organizations together that we can manipulate, that we can shift and change, that help us to resolve this conflict so that we move away from discrimination and move closer towards actually accomplishing the outcomes we need to for the organization.
Thanks so much for your call, Peter.
That's a tough question. I guess in one sense you're asking what the government can do, or what I guess society can do, using the government as a tool to pressure companies to make some of these changes. That's an area of policy I didn't really look into that closely. I know what happens in a place like Japan, where the government encourages companies to do these kinds of things. For instance, there was a law that was passed a few years ago that requires companies to do one of three things: either abolish their retirement age, and companies are allowed to have retirement ages and mandatory retirement ages in Japan, which is something that we don't have here, and it's probably a good thing that we don't. Either abolish that age, raise it to 65. And they also had to put in place some sort of a plan to how they would rehire people when they pass 60. That's right. There were three different things. They could either abolish their retirement age, raise it to 65, or if they keep it at 60, then they have to present a plan that will show how they can hire back everybody who wants to be hired back to work until they're 65. So I think in a way government policy can set the tone that we need to appreciate and take advantage of older workers. Another thing that the government has done is create sort of a pool of information and advisors that collect best practices from companies around Japan. They look at the companies that are doing this in the best ways. They interview them, figure out what it is exactly that they're doing, and then they act as advisors for companies that want to do this but don't quite know how to manage it. At the same time, you know, I kind of feel that society will force some of these changes, because as society ages, despite all of those government programs that I was just speaking about in Japan, I found the most interesting cases to be in areas where there just were a lot of older people. And so companies had to survive by employing older workers. And so, you know, the profit motive is a great can be a great motivator, and companies have figured out that, look, you know, basically I'm in this town where there, you know, 30% of the population is 60 or 65 and older. How am I going to keep my company alive if I don't learn how to employ these folks? You know, how do I keep going how do I make any money if I can't attract them to my workplace and make things suitable for them so that they want to continue working here? And I think that those two things in tandem are probably the best way to go forward. Certainly, you know, our United States is aging. We're going to have we're at about 13% or 14% 65 and older right now. You know, it's going up to 20% within a few decades. And so this will, I think, encourage a lot of companies. A lot of companies are thinking about this already, actually.
Let's go next on the phone to David in Irving. Hi, David.
Hi, Chris. Thank you very much. Back in when I was 45 years old, I was fired because of my age. And the idiot that fired me even told other people in the company that he was doing it because of my age. And I was able to go to HR and get a much better severance package with all that information. And it seems in corporate America, I was in sales and medical sales, and you look around at a big sales meeting and you wouldn't see anybody with gray hair. It was all younger people. And I would caution anybody in their 30s and 40s that are in corporate America, look at your own company and how many people are older or in their late 50s or 60s that you're working with. And if you don't see them, be prepared in your mid-50s to make a change.
Sounds like good advice, Joe. What do you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, corporate culture is really funny, and it can vary pretty dramatically from company to company. And so, you know, people make up a company, and if you have a group of people who sort of set the tone that that this is not a place for older workers, you know, it can be really hard to dislodge that that sort of tenor and that attitude and that atmosphere. Getting back to something that you said reminded me of this idea of, I think probably everybody these days should start to reconsider their careers when they're in their mid to late 40s and start to think about whether they're in a position that they could see themselves continuing in until, say, 65 or 70. If you're in a job that that you either because of the company atmosphere is not going to be favorable to you as you get older, or if it's just not a job that you can see yourself doing beyond a certain age and you want to continue working, then it may be time, you know, for us to develop this habit of kind of a mid-career reassessment. What kind of skills am I going to need to make myself relevant 20 years from now or 10 years from now? What can I do to make sure that I'm not going to hit the end of the road when I'm 57 and I'm going to still be able to be viable as a worker as I go into my 60s? I think, you know, some of these things – this is what I liked about the job councils in Sweden, even though you had to be laid off in order to get thrown into one of them. But once you got in, they force you to think about all of these things. And I think it would be really nice in my sort of idealistic conception of it that people begin thinking about this when they're 45 or 50, about just to sort of reassess, what am I going to do for the second half of my career? What can I do to make sure that it's successful?
Once more to the phones, we have Hugo on the line in Dallas. Hi, Hugo.
Hi, Chris. My question pertains to essentially the loyalty felt from employees to companies and companies to employees, whether they plan on retiring or not, whether they state the intention to or not. For example, workers who intend on working and state the intent to work through their 70s. If that has any bearing on the company's decision to maybe I need to trim this person because they're going to retire soon, they're costing so much, and will leave soon anyway, especially in environments like at-will states where there aren't any contracts or time terms to employment.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess that gets into sort of individual cases where there might be all sorts of different reasons, and a lack of loyalty on one side or the other might be used as a reason to go ahead with encouraging someone to retire early. I do know that this gets back a little bit to what I was talking about before about smaller companies, that there is a sense of loyalty in both directions, because in smaller companies, if there's somebody who's been working, if people have been working together for 30 or 40 years, you know, they develop loyalties to one another. And I found that it's much easier for older workers to continue going on until whatever time that they want to quit in those types of organizations. Not only are smaller companies often more agile and able to change policies to suit changing conditions, but also there's a human factor that you lose when you get into huge companies where nobody really knows anyone else, or you don't know your boss, or you don't meet the people in HR except if there's some sort of a crisis brewing. And so sometimes workers will say, well, I'm dedicated to the boss and that's why I continued working, or I really believe in this company and that's why I continue working. You know, if I were working for some other company, I would have quit, you know, years ago, but I wanted to stick with it because I want to see this company succeed, and it works in both ways too, you know.
It seems like in the modern economic reality of no more pensions and people trying to save in, you know, defined contribution plans, that sort of thing, we may not have a choice about whether we will retire or not, right? The money just may not be there. But what we want to do is preserve the choice to continue working where we've been working. We want to not be forced out.
Right, right. And usually that is the smoothest way. To do this is to be able to continue working in the place where you've been working before, because otherwise you're sort of throwing yourself out into the mercy of the job market, and that's quite a gamble. The one thing that we haven't talked about and I wanted to mention was just precisely what you said about pensions and retirement. In 1975, 58% of private sector workers had a pension. That is a pension that you get paid until you die. And in 2012, that's down to 22%. So this is something that's really driving a lot of this. This is the uncertainty about whether I'm going to be able to retire at all. And the 401k system has not really adequately replaced that. People don't save enough and they don't manage their money as well as it used to be managed, at least in some of the company pensions. And so a lot of people, sadly, want to continue working for pretty much financial reasons.
Do you think attitudes about working past traditional retirement age among both workers and their colleagues, are they changing as fast as economic realities, or does it still feel, even to people who stay at work, like they just have to be doing this because they don't have quite enough?
It really runs the gamut. I don't know what the latest polls are as far as attitudes among older workers as to whether they'd rather be somewhere else but have to stay at work because they need the money. But I have noticed a type of older worker mentality, a certain type of personality. I'm talking about people who are working well past retirement age, you know, people who are working in their 70s. And they're lucky. They've had good health, but they also are very optimistic and very people-oriented people. They like a lot of social interaction, and that seems to motivate them to continue working. I don't believe that we should raise retirement ages just for the sake of forcing people to work for financial reasons. That seems to be a particularly cruel way to encourage people to stay in the workforce.
Journalist Joseph Coleman is Roy W. Howard Professor of Practice in the Indiana University Media School. His new book is called Unfinished Work: The Struggle to Build an Aging American Workforce. Joe, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. We had help on the phones today from Celine Alba. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org, or I have a Twitter feed @ChrisBoydThink. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.